What is up, plant people? It is Tuesday, May the 5th, 2020, and this is Vikram Baligi, your host for another episode of the Plantthropology Podcast, the show where we talk to really cool plant people and learn a little bit more about them and what they do. Y'all, it's episode 15. Can you believe it? I kind of can't. I know that sounds a little crazy to be so excited about episode 15, but statistically, the average number of podcast episodes for any given show is 14. So we've beaten the curve, y'all, and there is nowhere to go but up but here from here. And so just so excited to be with you. You know, I don't talk about numbers a whole lot, but when I started this show back in November of 2019, I'd set this arbitrary goal for myself to hit 5,000 downloads. By episode 15. And yes, we've had a few bonus things and extra things in there. So we've already done more than 15 total episodes, but we're actually probably going to hit 5,000 downloads this week. And that's because y'all are so awesome. And to celebrate how awesome you are, we're going to do another sticker giveaway. So if you leave me a review on either Podchaser or Apple Podcasts, take a screenshot of it, send it to me by email or on social media, however you can get it to me, I'll send you a pack of two stickers and a handwritten thank you note. And if you're out there and we've talked about me sending you a sticker, I haven't forgotten about you. Life is just apparently crazy during a pandemic lockdown. So the next thing I want to talk about, I mentioned last week that we have a new partner for the show, and that is Pecan Ridge here in Lubbock, America. So whether you need a Mother's Day gift, some custom and wonderful pecan shelling from your produce that you got off your tree, if you like pecan clusters or pecan pie recipes, or really fun stuff on social media, check out Pecan Ridge on Facebook and Instagram and head over to their website at pecanridge.com. You can order online. They'll ship right to your door. And if you use the promo code PLANTPEOPLE, all one word, at checkout, you get 10% off your order. So make sure you reach out to them and tell them I sent you. So today's episode is really, really exciting. So my guest for today is someone that I've kind of followed for a while since I heard her on the Ologies podcast quite a while ago. And her name is Dr. Sarah McAnulty. Now, Dr. McAnulty is a squid researcher. And you may be thinking, squid, what does that have to do with plants? And I think when I asked her to be on the show, she thought the same thing probably. But Sarah is also the founder and the director and the lifeblood behind an organization called Skype a Scientist that connects scientists and researchers with the public, from people at home right now during the lockdown to school classrooms and kind of everyone between. It's a free service. It's wonderful. I've gotten to Skype into a couple of classrooms over the past year and talk about plant science, and it's just so much fun. So I was so excited when Dr. McAnulty agreed to be on the show, tell me a little bit about Skype a Scientist, and we talk about houseplants a little bit. And I, of course, am such a nerd that I couldn't let her get off of the show without me talking about squid just a little bit, even though it has nothing to do with plants. But I hope you're really excited. I know I am. So buckle up, listen in, and get ready for episode 15 of Plantthropology. Welcome, everyone. I'm here today with Dr. Sarah McAnulty, who is a squid scientist, a science communicator, and actually one of my personal, I guess, heroes in science communication. I really have been following Sarah's journey since I heard her on another podcast called Ologies, which I've talked about before. But Sarah, how are you today?
Doing awesome. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for being with me. How are you holding up so far through all this whatever's going on?
Well, I'm an extrovert that hasn't seen another human in multiple days. So I'm going a little bananas, but overall we're doing good.
Yeah.
Nobody's sick, you know, so I really have no grounds to complain.
Sure. No, and that's good. And I'm glad to hear that. But no, I'm kind of the same way. I'm very extroverted and, you know, I love my family, but after a while I'm like, I came up to the office to record this because, like, I just have to get out of the house for a few minutes.
Yeah.
So we'll just kind of jump right into it. But tell me a little bit about yourself. Just what do you do? What's your background? What did you study in school? All that kind of stuff.
Yeah, sure. So I am a squid biologist and I'm also a science communicator. And now my official job title is executive director at the nonprofit Skype a Scientist, which I founded back in 2017. We'll talk more about what Skype a Scientist is and all that we do. I was super interested in squid from when I was little and like around eight. And so I've been obsessed with cephalopods ever since. And so I pursued a career in science. I'm also in title an assistant research professor at UConn, which is great for kind of connections in general. Yeah. And so that's also where I did my PhD. I did my PhD at the University of Connecticut, UConn.
Cool.
And so, yeah, I study Hawaiian bobtail squid, although my current job is really all about connecting scientists with the public. It's not really in the lab working with squid, although I do still do field work. And so my job is a pretty strange patchwork of stuff. Like the main thing is communicating science, helping run this program, get people excited about science communication, confident about their abilities to do it, and helping facilitate them getting directly to the public and getting that connection as smoothly as possible for all as many scientists as we possibly can.
That's awesome. And that's such an important mission, I think. We talk about that a lot on this show about how academic knowledge should not stay inside the walls of academia, how we've got to, you know, open the gates, so to speak, and get that message out there. So what so, you know, we talked about, you know, how you got interested in squid, which squid are super interesting, I think, too. I don't know much about them, except that they're frighteningly intelligent, but they're super cool.
They're the best. They're the coolest. Like, squid are amazing for so many reasons. And I could go on for hours about that. But just to keep it short and sweet, basically, I think squid are fascinating and fun to study because they diverged from us in evolution so long ago. But they're really behaviorally complex and smart and kind of at the top of the invertebrate game in terms of behavioral complexity. And so that is, I think, why they're so cool, because in some ways, they're quite like us. You know, they're more relatable than looking at a clam. Like when you look at a clam, like,
yeah,
you're not really emotionally connecting. Like you can't make eye contact with a clam.
Like it doesn't have a face. What do you do?
Like what is a clam's life? You know, like you can think about it, but, you know, it's hard to really feel what it feels to be a clam, but you see a squid and you're like, okay, not only can I make eye contact with a squid, but the squid is looking back at me as much as I'm looking at it. And you can really like read a curiosity in there. And, you know, short of anthropomorphizing, which is very easy to do with squid because they do seem so like engaging and just sort of enigmatic and cool. And so I think it's really cool to see how an animal who evolved on our planet came up with solutions that sometimes are very similar to us for solving the problems that any life form has. And other times comes up with completely wild, different stuff, like color changing skin. Like what? That's amazing.
Yeah.
And so kind of digging deep into all the ways that we're the same and not is really fun.
That's awesome. And you know, for my listeners that are like, I thought this was a plant podcast. It is. And we'll talk about Sarah is a houseplant enthusiast from what I understand. So we'll talk about that a little bit in a minute. But I think it's important as we talk about biology and science in general to kind of cover our bases. And there's so much complexity in evolution and coevolutions and just the way that ecosystems work that as we talk about, you know, one aspect of biology, I love for people to be able to hear that here's a thing that's different, but everything's still connected. Like the way we treat our you know, terrestrial plants and terrestrial ecosystems has so much to do with these animals that you study and the ecosystems that you study, and that everything we do is part of this closed system. And so, I think it's cool that we can get a little bit of diversity even in a nerdy plant podcast like this, and maybe just be able to see and piece this puzzle together just a little bit.
Yeah, I'm all for it.
That's awesome. So, okay. You know, when we were kind of chatting on Twitter, setting this up, I was like, well, so what do you know about plants? And you said, well, I have lots of house plants. So tell me your experience with, and I'm looking at your background here, and I can't tell exactly what those are. Some kind of palms.
Some kind of palm. I also don't know what kind of palm they are, but there's a lot of them. So I just moved from Connecticut to Philadelphia. And so I went from being in a pretty lush green place into a not super lush place. Although right. I love Philadelphia. I have nothing against Philadelphia. Philadelphia is where I grew up, and I'm so glad to be home again. But so I'm like stacking the house full of houseplants. But yeah, I just got my first orchid. I'm feeling pretty good about that.
Yeah, that's exciting.
Yeah, up in my house in Connecticut, I had a room that had a bunch of ivy and pothos plants and yeah. some other kind of plant that vaguely looks like that, but I don't know what it is. And I strung them all across the ceiling. So it was like an entire canopy of plants in one of our rooms. So
oh, that's
I
awesome.
Like being around green stuff in addition to ocean stuff.
No, that's awesome. And it's funny that you mentioned the difference between like being able to connect with something like a squid that has a face and something like a clam that doesn't. So it's possible that I'm losing my mind a little bit. I've been working, you know, I run a greenhouse here in Texas, and you know, I'm considered critical staff at my university because stuff still has to keep getting watered. And so I've been here watering and taking care of things. And like, I've been putting googly eyes on our plants in the greenhouse. Like that, I'm up to a dozen or more. I don't know. I haven't found myself like talking to them out loud yet. We may get there. But
I see no problem with talking out loud to your plants. I mean,
okay.
Being around living things is just good for you, whether yeah. it's a cat or a snake or a squid or a plant.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I agree with that. And so, yeah, so just to make them a little more personal, I've been putting faces on my plants, but that's, you know, that's neither here nor there.
We're
that's
all
fine.
Hoping the best we can in I the time
think we're doing,
that we're in. Yeah.
We're doing our best for sure. So I actually have, so you study just squid. Do you ever like branch into octopi? Octopuses or octopi?
It's octopuses, unfortunately.
Okay.
You just have to like say it a couple times confidently in the mirror, and then one day you just can say octopuses in front of 100 people and not even feel bad about it.
Gosh, that's a struggle.
It's the worst part of being a cephalopod biologist is having to say octopuses repeatedly, I think. That and like the dead shrimp smell when you're cleaning out eggs. That's probably the worst part. But anyway, so I don't study octopuses, but I have worked with cuttlefish. Well, I worked with octopuses for like a minute back when I was an undergrad, but I'm really more of a decapod cephalopod person. So
okay. That's
8 arms and 2 tentacles. So 8 or 10 limbs altogether.
Okay.
And so squid and cuttlefish.
8 arms and 2 tentacles. So what's the difference between an arm and a tentacle?
Yeah, let's get into it. So an arm is an appendage that is has suction cups all the way down, and they're muscular hydrostats. So like
okay. Like
a elephant's trunk, for example, is one of those things that move around using like pressure internally to move. And so those are the arms. They're not super stretchy, but they are strong. And then, and of course they have suction cups all from front, the whole thing. And okay. Then we have tentacles. And so octopuses only have arms. They've got 8 arms, no tentacles. Although honestly, if you want to call it a tentacle, like I'm not going to get into semantics with an 8-year-old about it, like it's fine. But if we do want to talk about what it is in terms of science lingo, let's get into it. So a tentacle is something that's super, in a squid anyway, and cuttlefish, is super stretchy. They only have suction cups at the ends, which are called clubs. And so when a cuttlefish or squid is hunting, while they're out swimming around looking for food, their tentacles are kind of curled up. And each squid and cuttlefish is a little different, but generally curled up in like little spaces in between the arms, kind of. And okay. So when they see a prey item, they do something that's like super cute and interesting. They basically turn their arms and tentacles into this little cone, and the tentacles will be sticking out. You'll see the little clubs like sticking out from in between, right at the point of the cone. Mm-hmm. And then when they go to attack, they shoot those tentacles out and then kind of like clap them together to grab the prey item. And at the clubs of the tentacles, many squid species have basically rings of teeth. So they really dig into whatever they're grabbing. So they don't only have the suction cup action, they've got suction plus teeth, which is spooky, but it's
pretty metal.
So that's life. And so, one I can think of off the top of my head has like swivel hooks. So that's the colossal squid. So on the suction cups, they have these little hooks that are like completely swivel around. So when the prey starts to swim away, the hooks will swivel and hook in. So it's just
Wow.
Bananas. So anyway, long story short, tentacles, there are only two of them and they're stretchy and like are the things that grab and hook into the prey. And then the arms are used for manipulating various objects in their life. They also have the ability to taste their world because there are chemical sensors on the suction cups, which is also so cool. So if an octopus ever touches you, it's also tasting you, which is weird to think about.
Yeah, I'm going to try not to think about that too hard.
Yeah, not too hard. But also, if you want to really think about it, you can. That's fine. Whatever.
Yeah, I might. So, well, I probably will about 2 a.m.
Yeah, exactly. When I wake up, I'm like, if an octopus says hello to me, they're tasting me. What are they tasting? How do they know? Yeah, it's very weird, but it's great. And so, that's what we have going on in the world of cephalopod limbs.
That's fascinating. So, okay, I read we'll move on from this here in just a minute and talk about actually Skype scientists and stuff. Great. But I'm fascinated and I've got you on the podcast, so I'm going to keep talking.
Why not?
So I read a thing on Facebook and it's one of these, you know, posts that floats around from Reddit or something that who knows.
Right.
Talking about an octopus breaking out of its tank to throw a rotten shrimp on its handler's desk. And it's like this octopus broke out of its tank and took this one shrimp and wandered down the hallway and, you know, all this stuff, you know, and it attributes a lot of like, you know, human pettiness to this octopus because I'm not sure there are animals that are as petty as humans are. There can't be, right?
Cats and octopuses, I think, come the closest.
Okay.
As far as I'm aware.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
Yeah. So there are all these stories about octopuses doing wild things in captivity. I think they are a kind of animal that needs a lot of intellectual stimulation in captivity to not just start wrecking stuff. So, I worked with octopuses briefly, and they are silly animals. They're vindictive, and they have they have people that they like and don't like. And even in a group of I had 9 octopuses that I would take care of every day, and this one octopus, every day when I was cleaning her tank, she would come up to the surface and just shoot me right in the face with water. And I don't know if she was trying to play. I think that's generally a kind of aggressive move. Uh-huh. And so she was a piece of work for sure. But then I had other octopuses that just wanted to play and just kind of wanted to put their arms on my hands and kind of feel around. And I gave each of them rubber duckies. And so they would pull this one octopus would grab the rubber ducky, pull it to the bottom, and then let go and watch it go to the top and do it over and over again.
Huh.
And so each octopus has its own personality for sure. This is probably true for many animals, but I don't know. Octopuses really kind of make it obvious that their personalities are very different from each other. And so there are stories about, lights being left on all night in the aquarium room, and then octopuses just messing with the electronics by shooting water into the electrical stuff. And I don't know, I don't know personally the people who did that, so I can't verify that that actually happened. But that's the kind of thing when you're working with octopuses that I would not put past them at all, because they're always just getting their paws into things that they're not supposed to be in. So when you work with octopuses, you have to lock their tank down to prevent them from getting out.
Or they'll get out. You know, we did an episode an interview a couple episodes ago about carnivorous plants, which are, as far as plants go, pretty wild. As far as some of them that will actively hunt prey and create suctions and things like that. It's weird stuff. But that's a whole other, I think when we start talking about octopuses and some of these incredibly smart animals, it's just really fascinating to just see how much complexity is out there. That's a lot of fun. And it's fun to tell people about, which I think is a good segue into our, main topic for today. So you started this organization called Skype a Scientist, which I'm all about. So I'll let you tell a little bit more about it. But the basics, for those out there listening that haven't heard about it, is this organization gets different scientists to deliver science content to classrooms via technology. I've done it a couple of times. It's so much fun. What brought this about? Tell me about this organization.
Sure. Yeah. So it was early 2017. The 2016 election had just happened, and there was a lot of basically anxious energy in the scientific community. I had been active in science communication for years leading up to that, but not quite as active as I unwittingly was about to become. And so I really was thinking, how can we get a lot of scientists to pitch in a little bit of effort to overall make a huge impact? Because scientists on the whole are incredibly busy,
right,
and overcommitted in general. And so I didn't want to have scientists creating their, like, basically having to reinvent the wheel every time they want to communicate with the public. I wanted to give them a framework where they can just, like, hop in, do some science communication, and then go right back to the lab to what they were doing. And so we were brainstorming on Twitter at the time about how we could best do this. And so we landed on classrooms. And so we were like, well, what's the worst that could happen? Let's just give it a shot. I set up one Google form for teachers, one for scientists, and just kind of put it out there on Twitter and said, let's see who bites. And I was expecting maybe 100 classrooms to sign up, and we had 800 sign up, like, in a couple months.
Wow.
It was unbelievable.
Wow.
And so, and about 500 scientists were in our database at the time. We now have closer to 5,000. But yeah, the general idea is, let's make it easy for scientists to connect with the public. Let's make many different types of scientists accessible to teachers and for other groups. And now we're starting to work on, in addition to giving them the opportunity to connect, also giving them a little bit of training, which will be rolling out this summer.
That's really great because, you know, and I know being an academic, you've had this experience where there's a lot of our colleagues in the sciences, in the fields, that need that kind of public outreach training. It's so important because, and it's not, I think, through any fault of the scientists, it's just not something we focus on.
No. And like, even when we're being trained, like, I remember I was a first or second year grad student, I think second year grad student, and I was giving my first talk for the department. And I knew that the graduate students in like two floors down who would be at my talk were structural biologists. So they're focusing on just the way proteins fold and how proteins interact with other proteins. Meanwhile, I'm talking about whole organ systems in squid, mm-hmm. which is way more zoomed out. And so I was using not enough jargon, according to the people who were training me. And so they were like, you know, we really have to get you to talk like a scientist and not like a working class Philadelphia girl, which is how I was raised. And I was like, crap. Okay. So I was like, so, you know, as I was going, I was getting more and more and more jargony. And I was kind of taking a step back and being like, okay, maybe this works in our small communities, but even when we're talking amongst ourselves in the department, I have literally no idea what's going on when people in my own department are talking.
Yeah.
And so it's just kind of the way we communicate with each other when we go to meetings with people who study things very specific to what we know. Sure, we can communicate quite easily with each other. But even scientists talking to other scientists are not super effective at getting the word across. And I think that's not a thing that the public realizes, that like, not scientists are not all knowing. We know a lot about a very narrow field often. And so I think it surprises people to hear that scientists don't even understand other scientists. It's not as though you're not smart when you don't understand what a scientist is saying. It's just, we basically invented a whole new language for communicating about the thing that we study. And so breaking out of that takes time, effort, and active practice to cut the jargon out and remind yourself, like, if you've been studying the same thing for 10, 20 years, it's hard to even remember what is jargon and what is not, because, you know, the words that you use are so ingrained in your vocabulary.
Wow. That, you know, and that's such a good point. And, you know, my experience coming in, so I'm hopefully finishing up my doctorate this summer. Maybe we'll
awesome.
See. We'll
Fingers
see. I've got a lot of writing to do. You know, so coming in, I did my master's quite a while ago. You know, I graduated in 2012 and then spent 4 or 5 years working in industry and in the extension service. So my job was, you know, public outreach and public communication and community education. So kind of like what you were talking about coming back in, I've spent so many years being like a generalist in terms of my scientific communication, and my project now is on water conservation. It's very much applied science. But yeah, some of my colleagues were like, you know, you need to really sound more scientific. And I'm like, but I feel like that's what I'm doing, because right. the people I was used to talking to was a general audience. And so, you know, in my mind, it was like, well, that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm taking the science and I'm packaging it and putting it out. But it's an interesting experience.
For sure. I think a bit of a culture change in science is certainly happening slower than we might hope. And so I think people are appreciating science communication for what it can do within science in addition to outside of science. And so I just, you know, we just got to keep hammering away and hoping that we break through to everybody.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you said now you've got some 5,000 scientists kind of mm-hmm. in the database for Skype a Scientist. So for those out there listening, and I know I've got some quite a few like high school teachers and elementary teachers in sciences and in other fields that listen. If you were a teacher or a homeschool group or really whoever who wanted to have a Skype a Scientist session done at your school, what would the process look like?
Okay, so here's what you want to do. First, you want to identify whether you care what type of scientist you talk to. Like if you want to talk about colony collapse disorder in bees, we can get you a bee scientist. And so what you want to do, you go to our website. If you have something specific that you want, we have a scientist search tool, like a whole database of scientists that are available for sessions. And you can type in keywords and pick out individual scientists that you think would be awesome to talk to. Okay, that's step one. Then you go to our forums. Go to skypeascientist.com for all this information. You fill out a Google form that basically tells us what you're looking for in a scientist. You can either just choose from 30 different categories of scientists, ranging from astronomers, chemists, plant biologists, marine biologists, any multiple types of scientists. Or you can type in those specific names that you picked out of the database. And then you submit your form. It is totally free. All we ask is that there are more than, well, during coronavirus times, we say if there are two people, great, that's a group. And if you have a kid at home during coronavirus times, we ask that a parent fill out the form and not the under 18 person fill out the form. Okay, but then you fill out your form, you hit submit. Within about a week, you're going to get an email with the scientist you've been matched with and their contact information. You hit a button that says confirm your matches just to say, you know, I'm still interested. I still want to be part of this program. I promise I'll contact my scientist. And from there, you set up a time to chat just like you would with any other meeting. And so this is all going to be Q&A based. It's not as though the scientist is going to get up there and start lecturing your group about what they study. So they may send some information your way, maybe like a TED talk. It might be theirs. It might not be theirs. It's fine. Maybe a YouTube video or blog post, just to give you a sense of like what it is that they're an expert in. Because as we mentioned before, not all, like a scientist in marine biology, like marine biology is a huge field. So I know about squid. But if you ask me questions about sharks, I'm going to know as much as anybody else who is vaguely interested in sharks and watches the Discovery Channel. But I don't have like an expert level shark understanding. I might know the answer to your question, but like if you really go deep on sharks, I'm probably not the person to ask. So, you know, you want to know what the scientist really knows before you have the session. But then it's really a conversation. You can talk about how they got to where they are. You can talk about what their life is like as a scientist, like what their day-to-day looks like. A lot of times, and this is again, not during coronavirus times, but the scientists can take you on like a little virtual tour of their laboratory. So what I used to do when I was up at UConn, I would pick up my computer and just walk backwards around the lab so you can see what a lab actually looks like. Because a lot of times when you see laboratories in TV and movies, like that is not what laboratories look like. They are so... Man, I don't know how these movie scientists are getting funded, but their facilities are gorgeous and ours are less so. So anyway, you can do that. And so a lot of our program is quite flexible because we try not to set too many hard rules on things because we know that everybody's needs are a little bit different and every scientist has something a little bit different to offer. And so just have a conversation with the scientist that you're matched with and see what they can do for you.
And it's, you know, it's so much fun. You know, I've only, I guess, been on the scientist end of it, but it's so much fun. I remember last fall, I guess, I talked to I think it was a third grade class somewhere in the Midwest. And this one, and we were just talking, we were actually talking about water conservation. It was really nice because that's the, you know, module they were on. And I was like, oh, great. That's what I study. I can talk about that. But this one kid was like, he asked pretty much, why are there, like, he was really offended almost. He was like, why are there so many varieties of apples? I was like, what do you mean? He was like,
I don't even know. Yeah.
I was like, how do I answer that? And he was like, no. And I don't know that he was like very aggressive with this question. It was hilarious. And he was like, it was almost like there were too many choices. So he's like, we go to the grocery store and there's all these apples. Why can't we just be happy with one apple?
Oh my God. That's a supply chain question. That's like a horticulture question. Like, how do you even, some of the questions you could ask are utterly mind blowing.
Oh, they're so funny. But it was cool because we got to talk about plant breeding and why we do plant breeding and how, as people want different things, it's like, okay, if you want an apple that's a little bit sweeter, we can select for that. And we got to talk about how evolution works and how our like selection pressure on evolution works and all those things. So I guess the point is like, it's so interesting to get to talk to new groups of people and hear the questions they have and hear the way that they think about a subject that you feel like you know everything about.
That's honestly one of the best benefits for the scientist end, in my opinion. Like when you talk to other people who've been studying what you study for years, a lot of times you're trained by that group. And so you kind of get this framework for how we approach answering the questions that we're answering. And so when you have someone who has not talked to those people, yeah, the like mind-blowing stuff that they come up with is often really valuable for scientists, because when we've kind of been approaching the same questions the same ways for generations, we can really miss stuff. And so having that like naive approach to answering questions can be so powerful and like fun. And I
so
think
much
it's,
fun.
Yeah, it's so fun.
So we've just got a few minutes left. A question I wanted to ask you is, I've got two, but we'll start with this one. Where do you see this going as, you know, as director of this organization? What's next? What are the next steps? Where are we headed as this Skype a Scientist group?
Sure. So this is what I want Skype a Scientist to become. I want maybe not the scientist who is spending their career doing science communication, maybe not the folks who are really high power science communicators, but like the every scientist, like the scientist who is mostly focused on science. They are looking for a way to connect with people. And we are like your one-stop shop for science communication that's simple, that you feel comfortable like getting your feet wet for the first time in science communication with. And so you, as a scientist, you know that you have maybe 2 hours a month to spend on science communication. If that, you sign up for our program, you get training at a time that works for you. And then right after you get trained, we can put you into an applied kind of practice. So not only do you just get trained and then we say, okay, good luck, see ya, we give you the opportunity to use what you've learned immediately. And so for the public, we want to be a place where they can come to for experts in whatever they need an expert in. So we can have the scale to accomplish that. And for the scientist end, we want to be a resource for improving your skills and a place where we can kind of give you a task to accomplish in science communication.
Awesome. No, that's such a great goal. And I love that a lot, just that that it can be a resource for everyone.
Right.
Anyone interested in science at any level, I think it's great that this can be a resource for that. So a question, and I didn't prep you for this, and I try not to, just to see what, you know, to get people's answers kind of just offhand. But something I always ask my guests is, because y'all are all experts in your fields, is just for a piece of advice for our listeners. And that can be... So I'll ask you a little bit more specifically than I normally throw at people.
Okay.
So if you had a piece of advice for a kid or a student interested in getting into the sciences, interested in becoming a biologist or becoming a scientist, what would your piece of advice be?
I would recommend reading a lot about many different topics, because you never know what's going to be that thing that just like sets you on fire. And so instead of just like scrolling through Twitter or going on Instagram for many hours, which I'm not saying I don't do, just like, you know, watch some documentaries, read popular science books on a bunch of different topics. And once you find that thing, like, don't be afraid to dig deep early. Like, there's a lot that we can learn without being in academia. Like, there's so much information out right now that you can become an expert in something before you've even gotten into the like ivory tower of science. And so read a lot, explore, stay curious. And the other really important piece of advice is like, don't be afraid to approach scientists. If you want to work with someone or like, just talk to them, like approach them and don't be afraid to like maybe bug them a couple times. Cause sometimes scientists are busy.
That's awesome. Yes. We are human beings in the sciences. And I love that when people reach out, I love it. Okay. I think it's great. So did we cover everything you wanted to? I think we hit most of the high points. Is there anything else we left out?
The only thing that I want to make sure is incredibly clear to everybody is that Skype a Scientist is free for everyone. If you are a scientist, it's free. If you are a classroom, it's free. If you're a family stuck at home and you want to talk to a scientist, signing up is free. We are a nonprofit organization, and we're trying to make sure we're as accessible to everyone as humanly possible. And if our mission is the kind of thing that you think is important, we certainly do. You can check us out at skypeascientist.com, and you can support us on patreon.com/skypeascientist.
That's so awesome. So we'll wrap up. Do you, I guess, go ahead and tell us where we can find you. Where, aside from skypeascientist.com, your Twitter, Instagram, all that.
Sure. Yeah. So I am Sarah Mack Attack, which is Sarah with an H, M-A-C-K Attack. On Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, I think that's it. and Skype a Scientist, you can find on Twitter at Skype Scientist, on Instagram at Skype a Scientist, and of course at skypeascientist.com.
Awesome. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for spending some time chatting with me this morning. Again, I love what you do, and I'm excited for my listeners to get to hear just about all this cool stuff.
Awesome. Thanks for having me on.
Y'all, thanks again so much for listening. It really means the world to me. I can't tell you enough. But if you want to get involved with Skype a Scientist, head over to skypeascientist.com. Look Sarah up on social media. Look Skype a Scientist up on social media. If you would like to support them, they have a Patreon page, and they could definitely use your support. It's a nonprofit, and they're really doing important work, taking science and education and a passion for the world around us in rural schools and into places where it would not normally be, or not normally be as readily available. So, again, be a part of that. You can find Planthropology online on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook at planthropology.com. If you want to support the show, you can find us on Patreon as well at patreon.com/planthropology. Everything you donate goes back into the podcast or in horticulture education here at Texas Tech. So y'all are the very best. Thanks so much for listening, and I will see you next week.